hay balers, hay combines.
Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. Today we have a short but punchy agenda here. We will start by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 609. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 609 creates a rebuttable presumption of, in proceedings before a magistrate or tax court judge, a disclosure of confidential business records will cause harm to the taxpayer. It requires the court to weigh the potential harm that could be caused against any public benefit and allows the decision of the magistrate or tax court judge to be appealed.
Thank you. We have signed up John Marshall from AOI. And Deborah, can you come on up with him? Oh, please, please. The more lawyers, the better. I'm a former judiciary chair, so.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. John Marshall representing Associated Oregon Industries. And thank you very much for putting Senate Bill 609 on the agenda. As you can see, this was introduced at our request. It came out of a discussion we had during the interim with our Tax and Fiscal Policy Committee regarding an issue that we wanted to bring to the legislature's attention and has to do with the discussion that occurs in appeals before the Oregon Tax Court about taxpayer records that may or may not be made public. We introduced this bill and then wanted to share it with the Department of Revenue to see if they had any concerns. Over the last week, we've had an extensive conversation, or in fact, a couple conversations with the Department of Revenue. They did have some concerns. Our folks met with their folks, our lawyers met with their lawyers, and we've come to the conclusion that there's a middle ground that where we can accomplish part of our goal and placate some of the concerns from the Department of Revenue. And with your permission, Madam Chair, we'd like to continue to work, and we believe that within a very short amount of time, we'll be able to bring something back to you that will be simple and straightforward and agreed to by all parties.
Thank you. John, can you just kind of elaborate on what problem you're trying to address here?
I'll try. During a when a taxpayer appeals a decision by the county assessor, help me if I get in too deep here. When a taxpayer appeals a decision by the Department of Revenue relating to income taxes, property taxes, really a variety of state imposed taxes or local taxes, they can take that appeal to the tax court. During pretrial discovery before the tax court, as well as once the case actually goes to trial before the tax court, either the Department of Revenue or the respondent in the case, which was always the Department of Revenue, correct?
In these circumstances.
Okay. may request information from the taxpayer. And the statute currently requires the evidence before the tax court to be public documents. There are obviously taxpayer records, confidential business records, information relating to production methods. There's all kinds of information that a taxpayer would not necessarily want to fall into the wrong hands, competitors, and so forth. So there is a procedure whereby a taxpayer can make a request from either the magistrate or the tax court judge for a protective order. And what that order says is that we're going to look at this information as a part of the discussion and debate over this appeal, but this protective order indicates it's not going to be released. It's only going to be used for the purposes of the Department of Revenue or the taxpayer making their case before the magistrate or the tax court judge. There was a case where the taxpayer was very unhappy about the loss of that appeal, and the Department of Revenue made a request for a bunch of information that the taxpayer did not feel ought to be made public. And the taxpayer appealed that decision, was turned down by the magistrate. So what one of the provisions of this bill does is it creates a rebuttable presumption, and I describe that as essentially shifting the burden of proof. Now the burden of proof rests with the taxpayer to show that the release of certain information would create harm on the taxpayer. The language that the Department of Revenue had concerns with places the burden of proof on the Department of Revenue or the court. And maybe Marilyn could explain in a little more detail what their issue was. So that was the one issue. Another issue that we wanted to deal with is if either side in that dispute wants to appeal the order of the magistrate about the protective order, either the magistrate granted it or denied it, if either side is unhappy with that decision, their only avenue of appeal is directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. And obviously that's very time-consuming, very expensive, and so what some of the language does here that I think we're close to agreement on is allows a decision of a magistrate to be appealed to the regular division of the tax court first. And then if either side's still unhappy with the decision of the tax court, then they can appeal to the Supreme Court. So it creates a different avenue of appeal. And I believe those are essentially the other component has to do, and this was a drafting error, but has to do about whether or not the protective order can be issued either in pretrial discovery. And now, under current law, that's not allowed, and that was an issue that we wanted to have resolved. So it before the trial, there can be a discussion and debate and over the protective order.
Thank you. I feel like I'm back in judiciary again. I think I'm the only judiciary person on this committee. Well, anyway, thank you. Are there questions before? What?
I said our condolences.
Thank you. We'll turn to you now.
Madam Chair. We have
Can you introduce yourself?
I'm Marilyn Harber, Senior Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Justice, and the Department of Revenue has asked for our assistance on this matter since we are the ones who try the cases in the court for the Department of Revenue. We have looked at the bill, and we have had discussions, as Mr. Marshall said. We did have a concern about shifting the burden of proof on the confidential documents to the department, only because it's much easier to prove actual harm than it is to prove the absence of harm. And the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, prohibits secret courts. So to be consistent with that prohibition, the presumption should be in favor of openness and public proceedings as opposed to a presumption in favor of secret or confidential non-disclosure of documents. However, historically, over the years, and I've been trying these cases since 1985, we have either agreed with the taxpayer that information is confidential and agreed to a protective order so that it would not be subject to public disclosure, or we have submitted the issue to the court, and the court has been very willing and able to deal with those issues. So it really hasn't been a problem until the two cases that Mr. Marshall described. And I guess in fairness, I would say those were unique situations. They were not typical of all the cases that we have seen in the past, and yet they have highlighted perhaps one area where we can clarify the law to make sure that it's clear that protective orders can be applied during the pretrial phase. We need to discuss exactly how that language should read to accomplish that. We have, in fact, already agreed to those in practice, and the court has ordered those in practice. So It's not as though it's been prohibited in the past. It's just not clear that it's allowed, which is a distinction in the language that we can perhaps clear up through this process. And then the rebuttable presumption, of course, I believe they've agreed to remove that. We found it just totally unworkable and inconsistent with the Constitution. And then the appeal problem, I believe originally the direct appeal to the Supreme Court was put into the language of the statute to expedite hearings on these matters to the court of last resort. But we are very willing to discuss that issue with AOI and the attorneys and see if we can find some common ground so that we save everyone's resources, which is an important thing at this time.
Great. Well, thank you for that explanation, and it looks like you're on the right track to come back to us later with a collaborative effort. Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Haas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does the IRS do in this situation?
The IRS has a particular provision that addresses when documents can be made public, and it's in very rare circumstances. They don't have the direct equivalent of our tax court to deal with. They have the U.S. tax court, of course, but they aren't under a constitutional provision that requires an open court. So it's a little bit different circumstance.
I thought the U.S. Constitution did require open court.
Criminal cases, right?
It may be in the criminal area. I'm not certain about that, but it's certainly not identical to the provision in the Oregon Constitution.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Good luck.
And Madam Chair, this is the limit of my practice of law.
Mr. Marshall, I want to commend you. You did an excellent job. Kind of
myself convinced. I don't know about the
parsing your way through this.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wanted to speak on this before we close the hearing? Okay, the hearing's closed. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 589, Change Experts. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The land acquired by a Native American tribe is exempt from property tax if the land is within the ancient tribal boundaries of the tribe and is in the process of being placed in a U.S. trust. That's in ORS Chapter 307-181. The current exemption continues until the land is placed in trust up to a maximum of five years. The exemption sunsets on June 30, 2012. In other words, the land may not be exempt under current law for a tax year beginning on or after July 1, 2012. So what this bill does, Senate Bill 589, does is it repeals five-year time limit for exemption from property taxation of Native American tribal land in the process of being placed in a U.S. trust. And it repeals sunset of exemption for property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2012. It applies to property tax years beginning on or after July 1, 2008.
Thank you. We're going to start off with Justin Martin and Michael Mason.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. Bring that back here. I'm here at an occasional dual appearance for the Coquel tribe on the south coast and the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs in central Oregon, both of whom strongly support the bill. You have written testimony from the Coquel Indian tribe, and I should say my name is Michael Mason. I live in Portland, but I would not say I'm of Portland, having lived in a number of rural areas around the state. My awareness of the Coquel tribe goes back to 1986 when I started working with them on restoration. They were restored almost 20 years ago in 1989, and their focus in rebuilding their land base has been on federal land. They've been fairly successful at that. They have a modest reservation now of about 6,500 acres. And again, the great majority of that was federal land. There was no tax impact in terms of local property tax of acquiring that land. Since that time, the focus has necessarily been more on purchasing land, and you know that would be fee land that they would then add to the reservation land base. I won't go through all the testimony. I think it's important to note, and Attorney Craig Dorsey for the Siletz Tribes will testify this as to this as well, that this bill is very important, and this policy enacted by the Legislative Assembly in 1993 has been very important for the restored tribes, especially of Oregon, which is, depending on how you look at it, 6 or 7 of the 9 tribes. It's very significant for the possibility of achieving some level of self-sufficiency for the tribes, especially in western and southern Oregon. So with that, I wanted to comment briefly on the Warm Springs side of this, too. The tribes have a few hundred acres in trust. It's about, or in the trust process. They have several thousand acres in trust, but a few hundred acres in the trust process that are adjacent to the reservation that they'd be acquiring for. It's entirely farm and forest deferral. That's the case for almost all of these parcels, and it has always been true. So, again, this simply removes a sunset and extends a time period because in the past administration, we didn't know how long it would take to get land put in trust. When we asked the Legislative Assembly in 93, and when I say we, I actually mean personally for the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, and, of course, Attorney Craig Dorsey for the, at that time, the Kuzla and Kwanseusla tribes. When we asked for that, the process took less than a year normally to get land put in trust. It, now we have no idea. And in fact, some tribes have parcels that have been in Warm Springs for 4 years, some for over 5, you'll hear testified to. So we still have no idea with the new administration how long that's going to take to get land put in trust. I wanted to shed some light, and others will as well, on there's a disparity that may appear between your revenue report and what we have been talking about. The tribes together have about 1,000 acres that would be affected by this that's currently in the pipeline. There's additional land that's in the pipeline. Our understanding is that's federal or other government land, so it's not subject to tax at this point anyway. So we do need to get to the bottom of this regarding the revenue impact, and we'll get back to you with that. I would just add one last point that Department of Revenue has been interested in a clarifying amendment. We have language that we're discussing with them on that to tell us tell Department of Revenue exactly when an exemption would expire if there's a denial of the trust acquisition request. So with that rather long-winded discussion, I'll hand it over to Justin Martin. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin, and I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. I will be brief today. You can see we have a one-pager in front of you. We wanted to come today and share some specifics in terms of what Grand Ronde is doing. So thank you for the opportunity to speak to Senate Bill 589 today, and also thank you for the opportunity to work on the same side with Michael Mason, who hired me 12 years ago, to work for Grand Ron, and I've been blessed to work for the tribe ever since. So if it wasn't for Michael and Francis, who you'll hear from today, who is now with Coos, I wouldn't be here. So I'm always pleased to work on an issue on the same side as Michael and his representation of Warm Springs. With that quick history, the Confederated Tribes of Grand were about were about 35 miles west of Salem here, about 65 miles southwest of Portland. Originally, there were 26 bands that were removed to the Grand Ron Reservation. Originally, the reservation was 69,000 acres. Unfortunately, the Termination Act of 1954 dwindled that down to a small 2.5 acres in the tribal cemetery that still exists there today. Through concerted efforts from some of our tribal elders and members of the community, we were fortunate to be restored in 1983 in name only. It took another 5 years and the Reservation Act of 1988 to get some land back. That was 9,800 acres of contiguous timber. And as Michael mentioned earlier, it's very important for the terminated tribes and the restored tribes to be able to work to get land back into trust to meet our goals and objectives of creating opportunities in the areas such as housing, education, health and human services, and public safety. Specifically with Grand Ron, we've been able to take fee to trust land, convert it into a governance center, build a health and wellness center that serves the whole community, not just the members of Grand Ron, but the entire 35-mile radius. We're currently working to build a fire station. When I first started for Grand Ron, there was only one tribal member who was actually living on the reservation. That was just 12 years ago. Since we've been able to take some of this fee land, convert it into trust, and we've done 4 housing projects, a manufactured home project, 2 lower-income housing projects, an elders housing project, and we'd like to expand that elder housing again. Specifically, I'd like to cite the one-pager that you guys have in front of you today. You can see we're looking at 145 acres that are currently in the process, and I think what's important to look at here, and again, as Michael mentioned, you look at the date of trust application. You can see the first one's been over 5. We've got one that's 3. The third one has been in the process for over 8 years, and there's one at the 4-year mark. In 1993, these things moved much quicker. As we went through time over the past 15 years or so, they're taking quite a bit longer. So we feel Senate Bill 589 would certainly be another tool in the toolbox to get us where we need to be. Also very helpful with restoration and the reestablishment of the reservation in providing tribes opportunities to, again, achieve self-sufficiency. So with that, thank you very much again for the opportunity, and we would urge your support of Senate Bill 589.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have 3 other witnesses. I'll bring them all up at once. Francis Sande has come from over 100 miles. Thank you for doing that. Craig Dorsey and Dave Tovey. Tovey or Tui?
Tovey.
Tovey. Okay. I hope I didn't murder too many of your names, but you'll correct them for the record. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and members of the committee. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 589. My name is Francis Somde, and I'm the tribal administrator from the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lorem, Kwansayusla Indians. A bit of history and background. The Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lorem, Kwansayusla Indians they inhabited over 1.6 million acres of the south coast near Coos Bay and Florence, Oregon. In 1984, after termination in 1984, President Ronald Reagan restored the tribes to what I consider to be a transposition of numbers with a 6.1-acre reservation. Currently, the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lorem, Kwansayusla currently hold 405 acres of land, including 24 acres of what we call Balditch, which is the Indian name for the Coos, not Coosad, but Gregory Point and Chiefs Island in Coos County. Of those 405 acres, 250 acres are held in fee status. Of those 250 acres, 204 acres have had applications before the United States Bureau of Indian Affairs for in excess of the 5 years. So we will commence being taxed by Coos County and Wayne County for those properties. Of those 204 acres, 161 of those acres have been over the 5 year period. I want to talk a little bit about two of those parcels of property. As the earlier testifiers had stated, Indian tribes on the South Coast who have been restored look first to the federal government for the return of its land. And so throughout this period of time, we have been able to acquire back a 43-acre site, formerly known as Coos Head. That property has been held by the United States government, the United States military, since the 1850s when members of the Coos tribe were marched to the Coast Reservation. So that property has never been on the tax rolls until recently, and that was done because in the Bureau process, the property goes out of trust status or government ownership into fee status, and then you have to make application. The second parcel of land that we were able to acquire is a 24-acre parcel of land called Chief's Island, or Balditch. And this property is 24 acres at present. It is very sacred, very spiritual to the Confederated Tribes. It houses a tribal cemetery. There are archaeological discoveries at that site. And it is the annual celebration place of the Confederated Tribes where they return the salmon remains back to the ocean for a plentiful harvest in the future. So, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, that's my testimony today. We are in support of the Senate bill, and we were here in 1992-93, the Coos Tribe, along with the other tribes, and we're here today to ask for your support and approval of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Wants to go next.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Craig Dorsey. I'm here on behalf of the Siletz Tribe today. I've been working with this issue since I started practicing law in Oregon in 1979, and I've represented every tribe in the state, I think, except for Warm Springs in the last 20 or 30 years. So this has been an issue of concern for all of the tribes in the state. I'm just going to give you a brief background on why this exemption is necessary. I also taught Indian law for a while as an adjunct professor at the University of Oregon and then at Lewis and Clark, so this is my law professor kind of brief summary. The reason this exemption is in place is because of a law that was passed in 1887 called the Allotment Act. That act was designed to break up Indian reservations and move Indians towards assimilation into the larger society. President Teddy Roosevelt described the act as a great pulverizing force designed to grind Indian tribes out of existence. And federal policy has been cyclical over the course of U.S. history in terms of either getting rid of tribes or in embracing and enhancing them. And fortunately, those cycles seem to have ended, but the Allotment Act was one of the down periods of Indian history. And what the Allotment Act did was it was designed to give individual Indians 160 acres of land and declare the remaining land surplus and available for non-Indian settlement and homesteading. So between 1887 and 1934, Indian tribes nationally lost over 90 million acres of land. They went from about 134 million acres down to 43 million acres. The federal government realized that that policy was a disaster in about 1928, and so when Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act in 1934, the law that we're talking about now, which is 25 U.S. Code Section 465, was passed, not to give land to Indians, but to help them restore a tiny fraction of all the land they had lost. The best example of that policy is the Umatilla Indian Reservation. If you look at that reservation, it's called what we call a checkerboarded reservation, in that the reservation comprises several hundred thousand acres. It has an exterior boundary, but well over 50% of the land within the reservation is owned in fee by non-Indians, because the land went into allotments, and then after 25 years, the tax-exempt status of the land was ended. The Indians were granted patents in fee. Most of them were not ready to move into civilized society, and they would then lose the land to tax foreclosure and other incidents that happened. So the purpose of this law is just to grant a small portion of the land that Indian tribes used to own back to them. When I first started practicing law, there was very little land that was involved in this process, and the process took, I mean, the prior witness was talking about up to a year. It usually didn't take over 3 months. The approval happened in the Bureau of Indian Affairs at the local agency level. For Western Oregon tribes, that's the SELETS agency. When gaming happened in 1988, the process got more political and became longer and more difficult. And the federal government started distinguishing between on and off reservation fee-to-trust requests, and also required more political vetting of those requests. So now, rather than having those requests approved locally, they're recommended for approval at the local level. They then go up to the Portland area office for further review and recommendation. Then they go back to Washington, D.C., where they are scrutinized for whether there's any political issues that might arise, and they undergo further review. They can be appealed at that level within the Department of Interior up to the Secretary of Interior. They can be appealed further to what we call the Interior Board of Indian Appeals, and then they can be appealed to federal court. So, for example, the SELETS tribe got 40 acres of land a couple of years ago in Lincoln City in trust for housing. That fee-to-trust proposal was initially opposed by the city of Lincoln City. It was eventually settled, but it took over 8 years for the land to go into trust. So the initial reason for this exemption was just to facilitate that process, because the land can't go into trust unless all liens and encumbrances are removed. So if there's any property taxes owing, then the fee-to-trust conversion is delayed. It has to go back for further processing. So by granting the exemption, that removed that issue that the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't have to consider. 4 years seemed like plenty of time back then, but these days, as the other witnesses have testified, the process often takes over 5 years. When we've introduced this bill, we talked about the fact that we thought there was around 1,000 acres total among all the tribes that are in the fee-to-trust process. We saw that the Department of Revenue checked with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and there's more acreage than that. We're trying to figure out what all that is. The best information we've gotten now is the Umatilla tribe has informed us that they have several parcels pending within their original reservation where they're reacquiring this checkerboarded land. Most of that land is in farm or forest deferral status, and they will pay the tribes are required to pay all the back taxes before the land goes into trust status. 2,800 acres of that is also BPA land, so it's federal land that's not subject to taxation. The SELETS tribe has about 156 acres pending. The other important issue here is the SELETS tribe, for example, has intergovernmental agreements with Lincoln County, the city of SELETS, and the city of Lincoln City, where once the land goes into trust, the tribe compensates those jurisdictions for lost revenue. So the tax exemption and the tax payment is not an issue there. For example, the tribe currently makes an annual payment of around $86,000 a year to Lincoln County. We meet every 4 years to go over that exemption and the amount, and if additional lands have gone into trust, then the amount is adjusted upward to compensate for that. And we talk about the different services that the tribe is providing to the county. For example, we relieve the county of some of its social services burden by serving people. The tribe has a health clinic that's the only Medicaid provider in Lincoln County, so it serves the general population, and we come to an adjustment of that figure. So actually, the sort of theoretical amount that was noted in the possible revenue impact is also has to be offset by those kinds of agreements. So the Tsleil-Waututh tribe supports the continuation of the exemption. It served a useful purpose. It's a moderate piece of amount of land, and the tribes have enjoyed the benefit of it and want it to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. To your knowledge, you said you've worked with almost all the tribes except Warm Springs. Do most of the tribes or all of the tribes provide these payments in lieu of taxes to the local governments?
It varies from tribe to tribe. I know more tribes are doing it. I believe Cow Creek has an arrangement. When I got the information from Umatilla, for example, they make that one-time payment, but within Umatilla, that tribe actually provides all of the services within the reservation boundary to both trust land and non-Indian fee land. So they're actually helping the county out in terms of police, fire protection, and all the other services. I can't speak for the other tribes, but I think that's an evolving process and is happening more and more.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Tovey. I serve as the Economic Development Director for the Tsleil-Waututh Tribal Business Corporation. I'm almost also a Umatilla Tribal member and spent most of my career there as Economic Development Director as well as Tribal Administrator, along with a short stint at Coquille, along with working for the Northwest Tribes, affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians. One of the perspectives I want to kind of pick up on is was one Craig raised, and sort of the challenge we have is pretty much all fairly relatively new governments. A lot of the tapestry of regulatory structure coming down from federal to state to local to county to local organizations, those balance of powers, if you will, have been pretty well lined out over time. But here comes 9 blossoming new jurisdictions that are coming up and starting to provide a lot of these essential governmental services. As Craig alluded, at Umatilla in particular, while the reservation, and I think we just got to the tipping point to where actually there's more Indians on the reservation than non-Indians, but through the course of that time, and especially more recently, all those non-Indian reservation residents were incidental beneficiaries of all the community services that we were providing. In other words, they were paying taxes into another jurisdiction, but yet the tribe was bearing the entire burden for fire, police, zoning, other kind of services that there was no tax collection mechanism in place for that. So I think a lot of governments around the state, and certainly tribes are, either have formal or informal agreements with their counties, and certainly the 3 tribes I have worked with, Umatilla, Coquille, and Tsleil-Waututh, sort of have the deal already described up front. So whenever there is a transition of a fee to trust, it's sort of a known quantity of what that cost is going to be. And really, I think the negotiating point, if you will, that always comes up is who's paying for what community services. If we have a piece of property that's getting fire and police services, especially if it's far removed from our community, as we do with Tsleil-Waututh, that's a fair cost. That's a cost we'd have to come up with or cover in some other measure. So it's not a bad deal. The other point I did want to touch on is sort of there's always a kind of an internal decision tree whether we put a piece of property into trust or not. We have a large bank of properties that are in fee and expect them probably, we have no plans to ever convert those to trust. And generally what happens is that if you have a community service, say the things that Justin pointed on, if it's a health clinic, a housing development or something else, it doesn't really qualify unless it is in trust status for some of the governmental funding we have. So that becomes a decision point for that. But I think the other one is, from a business standpoint, is what's the value proposition that we might have with our either with our own enterprise or with another corporate partner that we're trying to attract to a particular property. At Umatilla, I worked for Cayuse Technologies, which was their joint venture with Accenture, and that was on trust property, but to generate that value proposition, because there was no tax on that trust land as defined, they actually had to create another enterprise zone designation, which we also have a bill coming through for that, but to really generate that value, that tax opportunity in conjunction with the state of Oregon to come back to make it attractive for that business to locate there. But the other thing I did want to note, you know, when you convert a piece of property to trust, it just doesn't, you know, our decision point isn't based on just taking it off the tax rolls. The other challenge it has is it ultimately goes into federal hands, with the tribes having a beneficiary interest. I forget the legal term, but these guys could help me out with it. But all the other federal requirements fall into place. So if we wanted to build something there, then full NEPA requirement comes into place. BIA has to review and approve any leases or any activity. So there's another kind of structural challenges associated with development of fee land. So I think every tribe is kind of weighing these things in terms of their development plans. And a lot of times the choice comes down to fee property is often easier to manage, easier to take care of, easier to develop, given the cases of whatever that particular land use is. But with that, I'll close, and thank you for this opportunity.
And thank you all for coming. Really, really appreciate it. Are there questions from the committee? Well, thank you. You did a great job making your case, and we will bring this back.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the pub. Is there anybody else out there who wants to talk on this? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on this bill, and that completes our agenda for the day, and so we're adjourned.